Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
You have said that Donald Trump was put in the White House by God.
You know, everybody else thinks it's the Russians. I think it's the providential hand of God.
Folks, President Trump is winning these battles against the GOP establishment.
If any collusion took place, it would be between the DNC and the Clintons.
You would think he would aspire to be the president of the United States and act like a president of the United States. But, you know, that's just not going to be the case.
We're back with another edition of the TrumpCast Book Club. I'm here with Philip Gurevich of The New Yorker. Hello, Philip.
Hi there.
And Katie Roifey of NYU.
Hi.
So for today, we've assigned ourselves The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. We did not assign the 10-part Hulu series, but I think some of us may have at least dipped into it. So the ground rules are you're allowed to mention it, but we're really talking about the book. We want this to be the book club, not the TV club. So first impressions. Philip, had you read this before?
I hadn't.
Yeah.
So I was curious because obviously it's been around for 30 years and I've been around longer. So I sort of vaguely, it's been a book that I've heard talked about since my 20s. And I didn't know quite what to expect. I mean, I'm not usually a huge fan of sci-fi dystopias. And that's essentially the kind of book it is, simply because the mechanics of explaining the whole setup often is such a preoccupation. And I think that is actually sort of clumsy in this book. But the idea which you get is that America as we know it, or as we knew it in 86, has been overthrown. It comes out about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through the book that it's only been 3 years since Christian fundamentalists disguised as Islamic fundamentalists had assassinated the president and killed everybody in Congress and decapitated the government, and that there's been a period of sort of sectarian wars absorbing the country, and that this is now a culture called Gilead, where women are completely subjugated according to extremely primitive readings of the Bible, and sort of certain biblical texts are extracted to justify. And there's a category of women, the handmaids, who are the breeders. They're basically sex slaves, but not for sex so much as for reproductive purposes, or at least that's the ostensible justification. Most of our cultural world, from everything that's published and everything that exists in art and culture, has been wiped away. And everybody somehow internalized this completely. And it seems like it's a kind of male hegemony, but at the same time, most of the people we see as enforcers from the woman's point of view are other women, which seems to be one of Margaret Atwood's sort of careful what you wish for when you wish for a world dominated by women. Oh, feminists, sort of like cautionary tales, is that, you know, women often are both agents of their own oppression, just as much as, I suppose, humans are, but also, you know, that a utopian vision can turn into a dystopian one very, very quickly, which it seemed to me intriguing, but rather crude.
I mean, as dystopian literature goes, one of the things really interesting and clever about the premise is instead of just projecting it forward the way most dystopian novels tend to do, you use the term sci-fi. There's no technology in it. There's no kind of futuristic stuff. It actually, it's not 2086 in the world of the book. In a lot of ways, it's 1686. It's gone back. Most of this is drawn from the sort of Puritan theocracy of the English colonies.
Yeah, and also one other element is that pollution has made almost everybody sterile. So only very few people can bear children. And so these women who are the handmaids are fertile, and that's what makes them kind of enslaved. That's the situation.
And women, not all women in the society are slaves, but
No. Most
women are. The handmaids are slaves, and then these other women, the Marthas, who are the servants.
And the wives are...
Are the Marthas not supposed to all be black? It seemed like that.
Oh, I didn't
the
get
Martha
that.
I don't think so. Yeah. They sometimes are, but they're not always.
Okay. But that was I found that interesting. Sort
but
of
the
compare.
Wives are also miserable because they aren't allowed. They don't have sex with their husbands. They have to watch in this weird ritual. The handmaids have sex with their husbands, and the wives are not allowed to work. They're not allowed to read. And one of the wives is actually a kind of accomplished career person at the beginning, the main wife. And then she has to give it all up because her dream is fulfilled and she's transported into this, like, you know, 1690s.
Yeah. So what, I mean, given that what you do in this kind of book is you sort of take recognizable things and try to project them out to some extreme, is the starting point for this book what was happening on the right when Margaret Atwood wrote it, or what was happening on the left, that is, in the kind of anti-pornography, feminism,
yeah,
you know, which is, seems to be a part of how this society has come about.
What I found interesting about it is, I mean, I think it's been kind of crudely and broadly misunderstood as this kind of feminist tome.
Yeah.
And she's actually quite critical of feminism. And she's critical of the feminism of the period that was, as you say, sort of brewing then. It was when all of that stuff was kind of just beginning and brewing. And
it was
so
like Andrea Dworkin wanted to actually ban pornography and had an alliance with the sort of religious
totally.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, she's mixing those things together.
So, and she also is kind of, there's a mother, the mother of our main character is named Offred. Her real name is June, but they call everybody of Fred. So that's her, you know, commander. And so her name is Offred, also June. And Offred's mother is a feminist, a sort of lefty feminist. And that character is not presented as a hero or celebrated. There's sort of a certain amount of irony toward her. So Atwood is actually locating her feminism in a pretty sort of sophisticated place, a nuanced place, where she is both critical of this certain kind of feminism and what it's doing, and also obviously kind of putting forward this very strong feminist message.
But what is she telling us, or what was she telling us in 1986 to kind of be afraid of? When Orwell wrote 1984, he was saying, be afraid that some version of our contemporary English socialism could be extended all the way to totalitarianism. You know, when Anthony Burgess wrote Clockwork Orange, he was saying that he was arguing that the reign of the psychiatrists and the sociological vision of society could become so dominant that people would try to challenge human nature. What's she warning us to beware of?
Theocracy. A kind of puritanical theocracy. I mean, that's the core thing. And then there's this afterword where we're told that the whole thing was a set of cassette tapes that were found and it's being delivered now. That period is over.
Right.
The Gileadon period is over, and there's an academic conference.
This is the coda to the book, where you have this, the novel, in effect, becomes a document that's then being read by
and
an
And suddenly
academic.
Everything is finally explained.
I
think there's a reference in there, isn't there not, to Iran? That there's certain parallels with Iran in that period.
Yeah. So
in other words,
fear these religious fundamentalist states. But I also think there's something interesting about she's also speaking to a world that has been more recently transformed by the feminist movement. So women didn't work to all women are expected to work, or almost all women are expected to work. It's been radically transformed super quickly. So the difference from 1963 to 1986, there's been a total you know, groundbreaking transformation of our culture. And she's saying, you know, you feel like women have these rights and we should take them for granted, but we shouldn't, because it takes 1 second and everything changes. So I think she was trying to say, we take for granted this equal world, and this equal world doesn't exist or is very fragile, or we're 2 seconds away from losing it. To me, that's what the book is about.
And I guess she made a point, which I've seen her point out in interviews, that every element of the repression came from some real society. And she's put
that's
them all together.
Well, I mean, maybe when I said I thought it was a bit crude, is that I felt that it was a sort of somewhat mechanistic reading of how an authoritarian society's made, which are totalitarian society in this case. There are references also to the communist governments that were at that time, and she occasionally pops out and gives you these references to historical events. But I mean, there's also she's also describing the resistance. So the story is one of both this incredibly swift, totally weird, quite kinky reign of sexual domination. It's a book that's very absorbed with like the kinkiness of mechanics of sexual oppression of women would take place in this particular thing, and including how they themselves sort of play into it. She's really interested in the mechanics of the kinkiness, but she's also saying, what would subvert this and undermine this? Well, that we actually are human beings through it all. And so we are going to crave the things that human beings do, decadence and love and human connection.
And conversation, which is also forbidden for the handmaids.
So conversation or, cigarettes or a nightclub or, the idea of prostitution being desirable if the alternative is sexual slavery, right? Because there's a transactional and kind of a hint of desire and a game in it and so forth. And the quest for love being the thing that will keep people going, and also that people just keep killing themselves. So, it's not a very successful enslavement. Then there are all these references to the fact, I mean, it seems like a very tiny world, this Gilead. It almost sounds like a city-state. Mm. And they're the colonies or these other places. At one point, there's a TV report where in Detroit, the Hamitic peoples are being resettled, which again sounds like an inner city reference to sort of, all the blacks are being dealt with out there. She shunts off a lot of other social issues.
It's just funny. Everything in it.
How's anything made? Yeah. Where does food come from? None of it's clear. There's also a war going on.
I'm now feeling the need to do something I've never done before, literally in my entire life, which is defend the TV show and say, because I'm not a TV person. But I feel like in this instance, I don't think this book is high literature. None of us do. But I think in this case, the TV show actually answers some of what you were objecting to, Philip, about the awkwardness or the sort of mechanics being too clunky. Like we feel the effort of constructing this universe. And it is answered in the TV show by two things. One is the kind of it's visually incredible. Like just the way she has the handmaids look and the way they move and the way you sort of get really vividly. You go to the supermarket with this person, but you're not allowed to talk to her. And you have these wings on your head. They have wear these weird bonnets that make them not allowed to talk to each other. And just the kind of fascism and the groups and the group identity, it comes across much more vividly in the TV show. It's also subtler.
It makes sense.
It's actually subtler. And it also is better in terms of the acting. There are really good actresses in it who are incredible. And it just comes across much more in a much more nuanced way. And even the scene, the show is incredibly faithful to the book. She has a scene that she talks about where the protesters are, this new army shoots at the protesters. And she also has a scene where our heroine, June, goes to the store to buy a pack of cigarettes. She's super stressed out. And her card is declined. Like, her visa's declined. And then
This is in the early phase, before this happens.
Yeah. And her visa's declined. The reason it's declined, it turns out, she keeps trying it, and she's really confused. She calls the bank. The reason is because they've blocked all women from owning property. But the way she reveals this, in the book is pretty good scene, but in the movie it's better. And the scene in the march where there are people going out to protest, and this kind of connects to me with our world, where obviously a lot of us are involved in protesting in some way, or we see it on TV, is that there are these protesters, and it's this really familiar scene. People are protesting this new group that's taken over, and somebody just shoots them, and they die, and then they stop protesting. And the way this works in the in the TV show is so much more dramatic and like upsetting and really vivid to us and kind of speaks to, it's not what's happening right now, but it just somehow gives a feeling that is much more chilling. And I think the overall, the mood of the show is so much more chilling than the book itself. So I think this might be that rare instance where the television show is better than the book.
But is it when it was made? I mean, is it that this story now has resonance in Trump's America that it did not necessarily have in Reagan's America?
When was the show made? It must have been made.
So the show is new.
The show is brand new.
I know, but was it filmed in, like, it must have been in the
can. Well, they must have gotten started on it. I don't know. They don't do anything explicitly. I mean, they don't, you know, there are no little winks.
And I think it's overplayed to say we're now in danger of becoming The Handmaid's Tale. Like, it's not like that. I think
that's the wrong question.
That's the wrong way to look at it.
It's the wrong question to ask, because books like this, I mean, first of all, it seems to be The Handmaid's Tale so closely modeled on 1984.
Right.
In every way. And the question to ask is not, is this plausible?
No.
1984 is not plausible. Brave New World is not plausible. The question is, does the extrapolation of this outer limit, this extreme,
illuminate
our society? And that's what, you know, that's where 1984 wins. And the question is, does this do that too?
There's one great moment where her bank account's been taken away and she loses her job in this really dramatic scene where all women lose their job everywhere. And she wonders whether her husband likes it. And he's a nice guy. He's a great liberal person.
It's a really good scene.
And she doesn't want to ask him. And she somehow never says to him, like, do you like this, actually? But she gets this feeling. He says to her, I'll take care of you, which is sweet. But it really cuts at the heart. And this is why I really felt like she does get ambiguity in here.
Yeah.
And it cuts at the heart of an compelling question here, which is, do the men in The Handmaid's Tale actually secretly kind of like this new world and what it means, even the nice guys? And I feel like there's something in that question. Does the commander like being the commander? Do the women? Do women like power over other women? There's a lot of questions in here where I feel like she's pushing at that. And at the change of, is there something underlying some power structures here that are so cartoonishly played out in this book, they're actually really true about our world? And to me, that was kind of, that raised pretty interesting questions. And I think it, you know, we have to, I think it accounts for some of the kind of way people were mesmerized with the series in particular.
I mean, did you think that scene was, how to ask the question, psychologically or politically accurate in the sense that her husband would have responded that way? I mean, clearly he was, you get why he's...
No, he just says the nice thing to say, which is, I'll take care of you. You have no money. I'll take care of you. That's like totally
but
normal
also,
thing to say. She's wondering, does he like it? And maybe he does. Yes, it gets sexualized.
I mean, he wants that night to like get it on.
Yeah.
And she doesn't. She's just feeling cool. She's not like totally turned on him at all. But she's, and then she starts to be creeped out by this feeling that like he's a little turned on by the whole like situation. And which is obviously turning her off, like by realizing that she's very much not in the mood because of what's just happened, and that he's in the mood despite what happened, but maybe not just despite.
Yes,
yeah. It's not a great scene, but it's a sharp moment. It's a very sharp moment.
And I think the power is that, and maybe I'm bringing my own thoughts into this, but I think some of the resonance and some of the power is, here's this rapid social change. Feminism has transformed the world. What are the ways in which we are either attached to or still caught up in some of the older power dynamics between men and women? And to me, that this book really raises those questions to the surface, partly because it's so extreme and almost uncomfortable. Like when Philip was talking about the kinkiness, it gets like really uncomfortable, both in the show and the book. It's super weird. But
it's very anti-erotic.
Yes, but it's also weirdly...
It's step by step and kind of breathless. There are all these little short sentences and it's all a little breathless. And also what happens is, like, because everything's fetishized, right? Mm-hmm. Every, you know, the outfit is fetishized. Every movement is fetishized. You know, having a cigarette, a glance is fetishized, which, of course, goes into this kind of puritanical view, like a glimpse of the ankles, right? Mm-hmm. So everything becomes super kinky. If everything is transgressive, then you're always like a tremble with thoughts about what is what.
Right.
And she plays that up very breathlessly. I mean, they're just like short sentence.
I mean, there's a weird fascination with, which we could almost say nostalgia about, and an almost sadistic fascination with that kind of old-fashioned power dynamic. Like you're saying, a glance means this, or her relationship with the driver. She ends up having this illicit relation with the driver.
Who's like the pro.
Yes, yeah. But it's all a little bit, it's obviously evil, the new world, but she's weirdly sadistically fascinated with every element of it. So I think the kind of weirdness of this dystopia is about that. And also she's questioning in a way how we're this change, like when things change, like, is it real? How much of it is real? How much of us are still back? Are we really back in the 1690s somewhere in our heart in some tiny way? Yeah. I mean, to me, she's kind of raising those questions.
Well, I mean, there's this huge scene, which is also one of the climactic scenes, in which the women are all gathered. All the women are summoned to some sort of public forum for a ritual punishment of transgressors. And again, these transgressions tend to be sexual. In this case, I mean, some of them are political, but they're always, those are the ones that we've just only heard about offstage or seen the bodies hanging on a wall where they're left after they're killed. But here, basically, all these women are gathered and they're sort of talked to by this nun-like, you know, school marmish woman who's like, now, girls, you know, basically, you're going to... And then they present a rapist. He is guilty of rape. Mm. Now, you know, and it's not... The book suggests that he's not, that he's being set up, that he's actually a political dissident. But he's being accused of rape because if you present a rapist, the punishment is, you know, they sort of blow a whistle and all the women can fall on him and tear him to shreds. And then they blow another whistle
like
and they
stoning,
back off.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And so this is what happens. All these women just sort of like start kicking him and tearing him and pounding him to death in a mob killing. And then they back off. And it's referred to again in this like little coda bit where the academics are discussing like, did such things happen? And indeed, we do have evidence that this was one of the things that happened and that the women were given this as a kind of release against the males. But it also suggested, you know, some sort of commentary on anti-rapist feminist discourse and maybe that it had its extremes. And I mean, it's a little, you don't want to translate it too directly because she doesn't. And I'm not going to say that I know exactly what she's getting at, but there's certainly a viciousness to these oppressed people. That she's describing, that is one of the important points she's trying to illustrate. But again, how does that tell us about ourselves? It tells us that people quickly normalize and mobs are dangerous.
Yeah,
but again, that's what I mean,
I think,
by it's schematic, it's crude, it's sort of obvious.
Well, I like the case Katie makes here for its value being sort of psychologically interpretive. That there's right. this, you know, that there's this. These backwards views that are still in people's hearts, even if they no longer articulate them. But I think I'm trying to put my finger on why the book was a little unsatisfying for me. I think the problem is that the extrapolation is not – it may be looking at this with the benefit of hindsight or too much context, but – the trends were actually in the opposite direction from what's being extrapolated. So what happened in the decade or so before this novel was written was Roe v. Wade. Abortion went from being illegal in many places to being legal everywhere. Pornography went from being severely restricted and books being banned in libraries to basically being legal and ubiquitous. So, you know, the trends in the period that's up to this novel, despite what might have been very visible either in feminist, a certain kind of feminist subculture, or if you were paying a lot of attention to Jerry Falwell's latest speech, despite that, the vast trend was towards women's equality, women's liberation, and feminism becoming generally accepted. In trying to kind of project this future, somehow the book was drawing on a presumed backlash that it hasn't turned out to be that much of a backlash. And I guess for that reason, it doesn't read to me as having a lot of insight into the world we live in, because even it's defining this outward boundary, but it's hard to see that outward boundary isn't so visible. Am I making any sense?
I don't know about that, but I mean, obviously, I don't really believe that, you know, a lot of people when the show came out were like, this is Trump's America. You know, there was a lot of sort of trying to crudely analyze, analogizing.
And people were talking about the book. I mean, I think we had this book on our list from the beginning before the show because it was one of
Trump
those things.
Book because, but I think that idea, which is the thing you think is unthinkable, this freedom you have or control you have over your own body or your own finances is a little more vulnerable than we feel. So that idea that this unthinkable thing is going to happen, I think we can all agree Trump saying, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is like nice people, you know.
Very fine people
among them.
Lots of unthinkable things have been happening recently.
That just happened, the unthinkable. But more unthinkable things will happen and have happened, where we just think that could not happen on our national stage. I think the idea that slowly, piece by piece, these unthinkable things happen, she kind of gets that. We've talked about Philip Roth's Plot Against America. He also addresses that issue, the kind of transformation of society very utterly. And I don't think Trump's obviously gotten there. He's been so far too incompetent. But I think the idea, another issue here is surrogacy, because the idea of women like having other women's babies is already like, that's one of the things going on here that's kind of part of the creepiness. Like, some people are going to be the slaves of other people, and they're going to have their babies and give them to them. That's one big imagination here. And the handmaids get very upset when they have to give up their newborn baby to the wife, which is happening. One of them tries to kill herself because of it. But I think in terms of, I guess I see a little bit of Trump's discussion about women or the Republicans trying to chip away at Roe v. Wade. I do think there is some truth to the idea that these things we take for granted, this world we take for granted, is slightly imperiled moment.
If Trump were dictator, you know, the country would look like the Jezebel nightclub scene.
Oh, yeah, that's
true. It wouldn't look like a handmaid's tale. There wouldn't be, abortion wouldn't be banned by decree. Now, maybe in Mike Pence's America.
Maybe in Mike Pence's America. This is more Mike Pence's America.
This is the Mike Pence Trump book, Pence cast.
This is Mike Trump's, I mean, this is Mike Pence's America. Remember when the not having dinner with a woman who's not your spouse, like, that's a little Handmaid's Tale,
right?
Frankly.
Yeah, no, that's true.
It's like a creepy Handmaid's Tale point of view.
That's the kinkiness right there. It's sort of like, it's all too exciting, you know.
Wait, and what's the phrase they say to each other, like God's eye or God's, when they have this greeting
under God's eye.
Yeah, it's God. Like, that's very Mike Pence to me.
Yeah, and I think that she was, I mean, at that moment, it was that idea of theocracy. It was the idea, and the commander explains.
Or like,
there was
is
a lot
radical
of despair.
Islamism, if you think about it, like, it's, this is more like Saudi Arabia, you know?
Yes, no, absolutely.
And I mean, I think what makes it also a bit of a misfit with Trump, not that she was attempting to fit with Trump, but I'm saying, as a, you know, when people try to say, well, what's the Handmaid's Tale telling us about our world now, is that although Trump's misogyny and sort of just sheer sexual assaulter profile and swagger and the openness around that he brought to his campaign, that isn't sort of the – sexual politics aren't the defining feature of Trump's 9-10 months so far. They're there, but they're not – I think many of us are aware of many other things coming first, whether it's – environmental degradation or race or, you know, sort of just sheer corruption, the dismantling of the bureaucracy overall rather than the sort of creation of a police state. That, at least so far, is what it feels like. How that extends, we will see. In that sense, it is a single issue view of this dystopian projection of where society could flip. Where it's most accurate.
They also really go for dissent. I think the way Trump treats a newspaper like kind of fits into The Handmaid's Tale, and the way they deal with like the written word or news,
right?
For instance, like, there is also an Orwellian kind of, here's what happens if you aren't obedient to authority for everybody. I mean, they have this organization called the Eye that comes and picks people up and like interrogates them and maybe kills them. You know, there's kind of like that.
No, this is a total secret police state. I think what it's best on is normalization.
Yes.
I mean, as something that there's a little spark of recognition when you're reading it. The kind of, it feels a little accelerated.
Yes.
The idea that all this happened in 3 years and everybody somehow either was eliminated or submitted so totally, so enclosed. But it's about the surrender to and gradual accommodation of. I mean, there's a Tobias Wolff short story that I read many years ago where, as I remember it, the line was somebody saying, you know, people always say how wonderful it is, how adaptable humans are. It's also kind of awful.
Yeah.
And that's true. You know, it's really, it's always a question. You want people to be adaptable, and then you find out that adaptable means that they'll accommodate the Stasi state, or they'll work with, they'll slowly accept things. I thought about it. I was reading this partly during summer vacation. And you're on vacation, everybody's talking about what a distressing time it is. And you wonder, well, is this going to look like some sort of strange decadence that we all went on with our plans and our lives if things really are hurtling towards not just a feeling of crisis, but an actual crisis?
But I think this book may have
North Korea looming and so forth.
Yeah, I'm just a little concerned this book may have us worried about the wrong thing. It's pointing us to think about theocracy and a certain model of totalitarianism when we've already normalized kleptocracy. We know we know what kind of dystopia we're getting with Donald Trump. We have a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
I don't think it's enslaving women and banning abortion and all of that. It's something not as bad as that, but pretty terrible. And we've already got it. And it's basically they're going to steal everything that's not nailed down and give it to their friends and ransack the government.
And pry up a lot of things that have been nailed down.
Yeah.
And give them away, too.
And you don't want to be I mean, you want to be watching for the Salem witch trials, but you don't want to be focused on the Salem witch trials if what's happening is very different than that.
I think you're dead right that it's really about Pence's America.
It is about Pence's America. And I think you're totally right. And I felt like the connections to Trump's America when the show started to come out were overblown in just that way, because that isn't what's happening. It's not what's going to happen. But yet I still found it sort of chilling.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Well, I think there's, you know, when they did have the Women's March, I mean, there, I think there were some people wearing those wimples. You know, certain, this novel becomes a touchstone because it is on school curriculums and so on. I mean, it's becoming one of those books that everybody, not everybody's read it, but almost everybody knows what it means. And it becomes a reference point as an outward boundary for a super extreme, much as 1984 is, and it's useful that way.
And I think it's also useful in this, you know, when you say Roe v. Wade was passed, I teach at NYU, a lot of students like really don't kind of undergraduates I'm talking about remember that or have any knowledge of it. And a time before abortion was legal. And I think it's useful to send the message of like these rights you take for granted are you shouldn't take for granted. You know, that idea that the world underlying our pretty equal looking world is a lot of ugly stuff. And I think this novel kind of vividly delivers that message.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, that would I would say that the strength of it is that it's not the problem with it reading it today is that it's not at all a one-to-one analogy or allegory or parable of what we're feeling and seeing around us. But the strength is that it's not really, it doesn't need to function only as a one-to-one.
I just want to make one argument, which is I found maybe more than you guys that the shadow of a kind of 1690s Puritan America is more powerful than we generally give it credit for being. So I feel like it does actually loom larger. And we sometimes forget that, especially in a place like New York City where we're sitting now. We kind of forget this sort of appeal, like in that scene I brought up where she says, does her husband like it that she lost her bank account? It's a little bit, to me, it's a reminder. It's a kind of very, I think of this book as like a nightmare. It's like a nightmare. It's a nightmare, but it's kind of a useful nightmare.
So we're going to put this on our TrumpCast list of books you should read to understand Trump's America, Philip?
Not to understand Trump's America. There would be other reasons that you would read it but not, I don't think that that's its strength.
Katie?
I'm going to say yes. Let's read it to understand Trump's America. Mike Pence is very possible America.
Right.
Yes, that's the diplomatic. I'm going to take the diplomatic position. Read it in case we get Pence America, which seems to become a little more likely.
Yeah, it's getting a little more likely
week.
Every day.
Read it in case you're hoping to be relieved of Trump's America before it's time.
Yes, exactly. The dark cloud of the silver lining. For Philip Gurevich of The New Yorker and Katie Roifey of NYU, I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for joining us for the TrumpCast Book Club.
Thank you.
Thanks.